Internet-driven companies, they try to stick to this core strength. Silicon Valley startups will build the information platform, but then let brick-and-mortar businesses handle the on-the-ground logistics. They want to win by outsmarting opponents, by coming up with novel and elegant code-based solutions to information problems. In China, companies tend to go heavy. They don't want to just build the platform. They want to recruit each seller, handle the goods, run the delivery team, supply the scooters, repair those scooters, and control the payment. And if need be, they'll subsidize that entire process to speed user adoption and undercut rivals. To Chinese startups, the deeper they get into the nitty-gritty, and often very expensive details, the harder it will be for copycat competition to mimic the business model and undercut them on price. Going heavy means building walls around your business, insulating yourself from the economic bloodshed of China's gladiator wars. These companies win both by outsmarting their opponents and by outworking, out-hustling, and outspending them on the street. It's a distinction captured well by competing well-known restaurant platforms in two countries, Yelp and Yanping. Both were founded around 2004 as desktop platforms for posting restaurant reviews. They both eventually became smartphone apps, but while Yelp largely stuck to reviews, Yanping dove headfirst into the group buying frenzy, building out payments, developing vendor relationships, and spending massively on subsidies. When the two companies went into online ordering and delivery, they took different approaches. Yelp moved late and went light. After 11 years as a purely digital platform that lived off advertising, in 2015, Yelp finally took a baby step into deliveries by acquiring Eat24, an ordering and food delivery platform. But it still asked restaurants to handle the majority of deliveries, just using Eat24 to fill in gaps for restaurants that didn't have delivery teams. The lightweight process offered restaurants few real incentives to participate, and as a result, the business never fully took off. Within 2.5 years, Yelp had given up, selling Eat24 to Grubhub and retreating to its lightweight approach. "The sale to Grubhub allowed us to do what we do best," explained Yelp CEO Jeremy Stoppelman, "which was to build the Yelp app." In contrast, Yanping went into commerce early and went very heavily into food delivery. After 4 years in the trenches of the group buying wars, Yanping began piloting food delivery in late 2013. It spent millions of dollars hiring and managing fleets of scooter riding teams that delivered orders from restaurant to doorstep. Yanping's delivery teams did the legwork, so every mom-and-pop shop suddenly had the option of expanding its customer base without having to hire a delivery team. By throwing tons of money and people at the problem, Yanping could attain economies of scale in China's dense urban centers. It was an expensive and logistically taxing endeavor, but one that ultimately improved efficiency and reduced costs for the end customer. 18 months after debuting its delivery service, Yanping doubled down on those economies of scale by merging with arch-rival Meituan. By 2017, Meituan Yanping's valuation of $30 billion was more than triple that of Yelp and Grubhub combined. Other examples of O2O companies in China going heavy abound. After driving Uber out of the Chinese ride-hailing market, Didi has begun buying up gas stations and auto repair shops to service its fleet, making great margins because of its understanding of its drivers and their trust in the Didi brand. While Airbnb largely remains a lightweight platform for listing your home, the company's Chinese rival, Tujia, manages a large chunk of rental properties itself. For Chinese hosts, Tujia offers to take care of much of the grunt work, cleaning the apartment after each visit, stocking it with supplies, and installing smart locks. That willingness to go heavy, to spend the money, manage the workforce, do the legwork, and build economies of scale, has reshaped the relationship between the digital and real-world economies. China's internet is penetrating far deeper into the economic lives of ordinary people, and it is affecting both consumption trends and labor markets. In a 2016 study by McKinsey & Company, 65% of Chinese O2O users said that the apps led them to spend more money on dining. In the categories of travel and transportation, 77% and 42% of users respectively reported increasing their spending. In the short run, this cash flow stimulated the Chinese economy and pumped up valuations. But the long-term legacy of this movement is the data environment it created. By enrolling the vendors, processing the orders, delivering the food, and taking in the payments, China's O2O champions began amassing a wealth of real-world data on the consumption patterns and personal habits of their users. Going heavy gave these companies a data edge over their Silicon Valley peers. But it was mobile payments that would extend their reach even further into the real world and turn that data edge into a commanding lead. Scan or get scanned. As O2O spending exploded, Alipay and Tencent decided to make a direct bid for disrupting the country's all-cash economy. In 2011, Alibaba spun off its financial services, including Alipay, into a company that would become Ant Financial. China had never fully embraced credit and debit cards, instead sticking to cash for the vast majority of all transactions. Large supermarkets or shopping malls let customers swipe a card, but the mom-and-pop shops and family restaurants that dominate the cityscape rarely had point-of-sale, POS, devices for processing plastic cards. The owners of those shops did, however, have smartphones. So China's internet juggernauts turned those phones into mobile portals for payments. The idea was simple, but the speed of execution, impact on consumer behavior, and resulting data have been astonishing. During 2015 and 2016, Tencent and Alipay gradually introduced the ability to pay at shops by simply scanning a QR code, basically a square barcode for phones, within the app. It's a scan or get scanned world. Larger businesses bought simple POS devices that can scan the QR code displayed on customers' phones and charge them for a purchase. Owners of small shops could just print out a picture of a QR code that was linked to their WeChat wallet. Customers then use the Alipay or WeChat apps to scan the code and enter the payment total, using a thumbprint for confirmation. Funds are instantly transferred from one bank account to the other. No fees and no need to fumble with wallets. It marked a stark departure from the credit card model in the developed world. When they were first introduced, credit cards were cutting edge, the most convenient and cost-effective solution to the payment problem. But that advantage is now turned into a liability, with fees of 2.5% to 3% on most charges, turning into a drag on adoption and utilization. China's mobile payment infrastructure extended its usage far beyond traditional debit cards. Alipay and WeChat even allow peer-to-peer transfers, meaning you can send money to family, friends, small-time merchants, or strangers. Frictionless and hooked into mobile, the apps soon turned into tools for tipping the creators of online articles and videos. Micropayments of as little as 15 cents flourished. The companies also decided not to charge commissions on the vast majority of transfers, meaning people accepted mobile payments for all transactions. None of the mandatory minimum purchases or 50-cent fees charged by U.S. retailers on small purchases with credit cards. Adoption of mobile payments happened at lightning speed. The two companies began experimenting with payment by scan in 2014 and deployed at scale in 2015. By the end of 2016, it was hard to find a shop in a major city that did not accept mobile payments. Chinese people were paying for groceries, massages, movie tickets, beer, and bike repairs within just these two apps. By the end of 2017, 65% of China's over 753 million smartphone users had enabled mobile payments. Given the extremely low barriers to entry, those payment systems soon trickled down into China's vast informal economy. Migrant workers selling street food simply let customers scan and send over payments while the owner fried the noodles. It got to the point where beggars on the streets of Chinese cities began hanging pieces of paper around their necks with printouts of two QR codes, one for Alipay and one for WeChat. Cash has disappeared so quickly from Chinese cities that it even disrupted crime. In March 2017, a pair of Chinese cousins made headlines with a hapless string of robberies. The pair had traveled to Hangzhou, a wealthy city and home to Alibaba, with the goal of making a couple of lucrative scores and then skipping town. Armed with two knives, the cousins robbed three consecutive convenience stores, only to find that the owners had almost no cash to hand over. Virtually all their customers were now paying directly with their phones. Their crime spree netted them around $125 each, not even enough to cover their travel to and from Hangzhou, when police picked them up. Local media reported rumors that upon arrest, one of the brothers cried out, "How is there no cash left in Hangzhou?" It made for a sharp contrast with the stunted growth of mobile payments in the United States. Google and Apple have taken a stab at mobile payments with Google Wallet and Apple Pay, but neither has really attained widespread adoption. Apple and Google don't release user figures for their platforms, but everyday observation and more rigorous analysis both point to massive gaps in adoption. The market research firm iResearch estimates in 2017 that Chinese mobile payment spending outnumbered that in the United States by a ratio of 50 to 1. For 2017, total transactions on China's mobile payment platforms reportedly surpassed $17 trillion, greater than China's GDP, an astounding number made possible by the fact that these payments allow for peer-to-peer transfers and multiple mobile transactions for items and services throughout the chain of production. Leaping frogs and taxi drivers. That massive gap is partly explained by the strength of the incumbent. Americans already benefit from and pay for the convenience of credit cards and debit cards, the cutting-edge financial technology of the 1960s. Mobile payments are an improvement on cards, but not as dramatic an improvement as the jump straight from cash. As with China's rapid transition to the mobile internet, the country's weakness in incumbent technology, desktop computers, landline phones, and credit cards, turned into the strength that let it leapfrog into a new paradigm. But that leap to mobile payments wasn't just a product of weak incumbents and independent consumer choices. Alibaba and Tencent accelerated the transition by forcing adoption through massive subsidies, a form of going heavy that makes American technology companies squirm. In the early days of ride-hailing apps in China, riders could book through apps, but often paid in cash. A large portion of cars on the leading Chinese platforms were traditional taxis driven by older men, people who weren't in a rush to give up good old cash. So Tencent offered subsidies to both the rider and the driver if they used WeChat Wallet to pay. The rider paid less and the driver received more, with Tencent making up the difference for both sides. The promotion was extremely costly. Due to both legitimate rides and fraudulent ones designed to milk subsidies, but Tencent persisted. That decision paid off. The promotion built up user habits and lured onto the platform taxi drivers who are the key nodes in the urban consumer economy. By contrast, Apple Pay and Google Wallet have tread lightly in this arena. They theoretically offer greater convenience to users, but they haven't been willing to bribe users into discovering that method for themselves. Reluctance on the part of U.S. tech giants is understandable. Subsidies eat into quarterly revenue and attempts to buy users are usually frowned on by Silicon Valley's innovation purists. But that American reluctance to go heavy has slowed adoption of mobile payments and will hurt these companies even more in a data-driven AI world. Data from mobile payments is currently generating the richest maps of consumer activity the world has ever known, far exceeding the data from traditional credit card purchases or online activity captured by e-commerce players like Amazon or platforms like Google and Yelp. That mobile payment data will prove invaluable in building AI-driven companies in retail, real estate, and a range of other sectors. Beijing Bicycle Redux. When mobile payments totally transformed China's financial landscape, shared bicycles transformed its urban landscapes. In many ways, the shared bike revolution was turning back the clock. From the time of the Communist Revolution in 1949 through the turn of the millennium, Chinese cities were teeming with bicycles. But as economic reforms created a new middle class, car ownership took off, and riding a bicycle became something for individuals who were too poor for four-wheeled transport. Bikes were pushed to the margins of city streets and the cultural mainstream. One woman on the country's most popular dating show captured the materialism of the moment when she rejected a poor suitor by saying, "I'd rather cry in the back of a BMW than smile on the back of a bicycle." And then suddenly, China's alternate universe reversed the tide. Beginning in late 2015, bike-sharing startups Mobike and Ofo started supplying millions of internet-connected bicycles and distributing them around major Chinese cities. Mobike outfitted its bikes with QR codes and internet-connected smart locks around the bike's back wheel. When riders use the Mobike app or its mini-app in WeChat Wallet to scan a bike's QR code, the lock on the back wheel automatically slides open. Mobike users ride the bike anywhere they want and leave it there for the next rider to find. Costs of a ride are based on distance and time, but heavy subsidies mean they often come in at 15 cents or less. It's a revolutionary real-world innovation, one made possible by mobile payments. Adding credit card POS machines to bikes would be too expensive and repair-intensive. But frictionless mobile payments are both cheap to layer onto a bike and incredibly efficient. Shared bike use exploded. In the span of a year, the bikes went from urban oddities to total ubiquity, parked at every intersection, sitting outside every subway exit, and clustered around popular shops and restaurants. It rarely took more than a glance in either direction to find one, and 5 seconds in the app to unlock it. City streets turned into a rainbow of brightly colored bicycles, orange and silver for Mobike, bright yellow for Ofo, and a smattering of blue, green, and red for other copycat companies. By the fall of 2017, Mobike was logging 22 million rides per day, almost all of them in China. That is 4 times the number of global rides Uber was giving each day in 2016, the last time it announced its totals. In the spring of 2018, Mobike was acquired by Wangxing's Meituan Dianping for $2.7 billion, just 3 years after the bike-sharing company's founding. Something new was emerging from all those rides. Perhaps the world's largest and most useful Internet of Things, IoT, networks. The IoT refers to collections of real-world Internet-connected devices that can convey data from the world around them to other devices in the network. Most Mobikes are equipped with solar-powered GPS, accelerators, Bluetooth, and near-field communications capabilities that can be activated by a smartphone. Together, those sensors generate 20 terabytes of data per day and feed it all back into Mobike's cloud servers. Blurred lines and brave new worlds. In the span of less than 2 years, China's bike-sharing revolution has reshaped the country's urban landscape and deeply enriched its datascape. This shift forms a dramatic visual illustration of what China's alternate internet universe does best, solving practical problems by blurring the lines between the online and offline worlds. It takes the core strength of the internet, information transmission, and leverages it into building businesses that reach out into the real world and directly touch on every corner of our lives. Building this alternate universe didn't happen overnight. It required market-driven entrepreneurs, mobile-first users, innovative super apps, dense cities, cheap labor, mobile payments, and a government-sponsored culture shift. It's been a messy, expensive, and disruptive process, but the payoff has been tremendous. China has built a roster of technology giants worth over $1 trillion. a feat accomplished by no other country outside the United States. But the greatest riches of this new Chinese tech world have yet to be realized. Like the long-buried organic matter that became fossil fuels powering the Industrial Revolution, the rich real-world interactions in China's alternate internet universe are creating the massive data that will power its AI revolution. Each dimension of that universe, WeChat activity, O2O services, ride-hailing, mobile payments, and bike-sharing, adds a new layer to a datascape that is unprecedented in its granular mapping of real-world consumption and transportation habits. China's O2O explosion gave its companies tremendous data on the offline lives of their users. The what, where, and when of their meals, massages, and day-to-day activities. Digital payments cracked open the black box of real-world consumer purchases, giving these companies a precise, real-time data map of consumer behavior. Peer-to-peer transactions added a new layer of social data atop these economic transactions. The country's bike-sharing revolution has carpeted its cities in IoT transportation devices that color in the texture of urban life. They trace tens of millions of commutes, trips to the store, rides home, and first dates, dwarfing companies like Uber and Lyft in both quantity and granularity of data. The numbers for these categories lay bare the China-US gap in these key industries. Recent estimates have Chinese companies outstripping U.S. competitors 10 to 1 in quantity of food deliveries and 50 to 1 in spending on mobile payments. China's e-commerce purchases are roughly double the U.S. totals, and the gap is only growing. Data on total trips through ride-hailing apps is somewhat scarce, but during the height of competition between Uber and Didi, self-reported numbers from the two companies had Didi's rides in China at 4 times the total of Uber's global rides. When it comes to rides on shared bikes, China is outpacing the United States at an astounding ratio of 300 to 1. That has already helped China's juggernauts make up ground on their American counterparts in both revenue and market caps. In the age of AI implementation, the impact of these divergent data ecosystems will be far more profound. It will shape what industries AI startups will disrupt in each country and what intractable problems they will solve. But building an AI-driven economy requires more than just gladiator entrepreneurs and abundant data. It also takes an army of trained AI engineers and a government eager to embrace the power of this transformative technology. These two factors, AI expertise and government support, are the final pieces of the AI puzzle. When put in place, they will complete our analysis of the competitive balance between the world's two superpowers in the defining technology of the 21st century. 4. A Tale of Two Countries. Back in 1999, Chinese researchers were still in the dark when it came to studying artificial intelligence. Literally. Allow me to explain. That year, I visited the University of Science and Technology of China to give a lecture about our work on speech and image recognition at Microsoft Research. The university was one of the best engineering schools in the country, but it was located in the southern city of Hefei, a remote backwater compared with Beijing. On the night of the lecture, students crammed into the auditorium, and those who couldn't get a ticket pressed up against the windows, hoping to catch some of the lecture through the glass. Interest was so intense that I eventually asked the organizers to allow students to fill up the aisles and even sit on the stage around me. They listened intently as I laid out the fundamentals of speech recognition, speech synthesis, 3D graphics, and computer vision. They scribbled down notes and peppered me with questions about underlying principles and practical applications. China clearly lagged behind the United States by more than a decade in AI research, but these students were like sponges for any knowledge from the outside world. The excitement in the room was palpable. The lecture ran long, and it was already dark as I left the auditorium and headed toward the university's main gate. Student dorms lined both sides of the road, but the campus was still and the street was empty. And then, suddenly, it wasn't. As if on cue, long lines of students began pouring out of the dormitories all around me and walking out into the street. I stood there baffled, watching what looked like a slow-motion fire drill, all of it conducted in total silence. It wasn't until they sat down on the curb and opened up their textbooks that I realized what was going on. The dormitories turned off all their lights at 11 p.m. sharp, and so most of the student body headed outside to continue their studies by streetlight. I looked on as hundreds of China's brightest young engineering minds huddled in the soft yellow glow. I didn't know it at the time, but the future founder of one of China's most important AI companies was there, squeezing in an extra couple of hours of studying in the dark Hefei night. Many of the textbooks these students read were outdated or poorly translated, but they were the best the students could get their hands on, and these young scholars were going to wring them for every drop of knowledge they contained. Internet access at the school was a scarce commodity, and studying abroad was possible only if the students earned a full scholarship. The dog-eared pages of these textbooks and the occasional lecture from a visiting scholar were the only window they had into the state of global AI research. Oh, how things have changed. The stuff of an AI superpower. As I laid out earlier, creating an AI superpower for the 21st century requires four main building blocks: abundant data, tenacious entrepreneurs, well-trained AI scientists, and a supportive policy environment. We've already seen how China's gladiatorial startup ecosystem trained a generation of the world's most street-smart entrepreneurs, and how China's alternate internet universe created the world's richest data ecosystem. This chapter assesses the balance of power in the two remaining ingredients, AI expertise and government support. I believe that in the age of AI implementation, Silicon Valley's edge in elite expertise isn't all it's cracked up to be. And in the crucial realm of government support, China's techno-utilitarian political culture will pave the way for faster deployment of game-changing technologies. As artificial intelligence filters into the broader economy, this era will reward the quantity of solid AI engineers over the quality of elite researchers. Real economic strength in the age of AI implementation won't come just from a handful of elite scientists who push the boundaries of research. It will come from an army of well-trained engineers who team up with entrepreneurs to turn those discoveries into game-changing companies. China is training just such an army. In the two decades since my lecture in Hefei, China's artificial intelligence community has largely closed the gap with the United States. While America still dominates when it comes to superstar researchers, Chinese companies and research institutions have filled their ranks with the kind of well-trained engineers that can power this era of AI deployment. It has done that by marrying the extraordinary hunger for knowledge that I witnessed in Hefei with an explosion in access to cutting-edge global research. Chinese students of AI are no longer straining in the dark to read outdated textbooks. They're taking advantage of AI's open research culture to absorb knowledge straight from the source and in real time. That means dissecting the latest online academic publications, debating the approaches of top AI scientists in WeChat groups, and streaming their lectures on smartphones. This rich connectivity allows China's AI community to play intellectual catch-up at the elite level, training a generation of hungry Chinese researchers who now contribute to the field at a high level. It also empowers Chinese startups to apply cutting-edge, open-source algorithms to practical AI products, autonomous drones, pay-with-your-face systems, and intelligent home appliances. Those startups are now scrapping for a slice of an AI landscape increasingly dominated by a handful of major players, the so-called seven giants of the AI age, which include Google, Facebook, Amazon, Microsoft, Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent. These corporate juggernauts are almost evenly split between the United States and China, and they're making bold plays to dominate the AI economy. They're using billions of dollars in cash and dizzying stockpiles of data to gobble up available AI talent. They're also working to construct the power grids for the AI age, privately controlled computing networks that distribute machine learning across the economy, with the corporate giants acting as utilities. It's a worrisome phenomenon for those who value an open AI ecosystem, and also poses a potential stumbling block to China's rise as an AI superpower. But bringing AI's power to bear on the broader economy can't be done by private companies alone. It requires an accommodating policy environment and can be accelerated by direct government support. As you recall, soon after Kajia's loss to AlphaGo, the Chinese central government released a sweeping blueprint for Chinese leadership in AI. Like the Mass Innovation and Mass Entrepreneurship Campaign, China's AI plan is turbocharging growth through a flood of new funding, including subsidies for AI startups and generous government contracts to accelerate adoption. The plan has also shifted incentives for policy innovation around AI. Ambitious mayors across China are scrambling to turn their cities into showcases for new AI applications. They're plotting driverless trucking routes, installing facial recognition systems on public transportation, and hooking traffic grids into city brains that optimize flows. Behind these efforts lies a core difference in American and Chinese political culture. While America's combative political system aggressively punishes missteps or waste in funding technological upgrades, China's techno-utilitarian approach rewards proactive investment and adoption. Neither system can claim objective moral superiority, and the United States' long track record of both personal freedom and technological achievement is unparalleled in the modern era. But I believe that in the age of AI implementation, the Chinese approach will have the impact of accelerating deployment, generating more data, and planting the seeds of further growth. It's a self-perpetuating cycle, one that runs on a peculiar alchemy of digital data, entrepreneurial grit, hard-earned expertise, and political will. To see where the two AI superpowers stand, we must first understand the source of that expertise. Nobel winners and no-name tinkerers. When Enrico Fermi stepped onto the deck of the RMS Franconia II in 1938, he changed the global balance of power. Fermi had just received the Nobel Prize in Physics in Stockholm, but instead of returning home to Benito Mussolini's Italy, Fermi and his family sailed for New York. They made the journey to escape Italy's racial laws, which barred Jews or Africans from holding many jobs or marrying Italians. Fermi's wife, Laura, was Jewish, and he decided to move the family halfway across the world rather than live under the anti-Semitism that was sweeping Europe. It was a personal decision with earth-shaking consequences. After arriving in the United States, Fermi learned of the discovery of nuclear fission by scientists in Nazi Germany, and quickly set to work exploring the phenomenon. He created the world's first self-sustaining nuclear reaction underneath a set of bleachers at the University of Chicago, and played an indispensable role in the Manhattan Project. This top-secret project was the largest industrial undertaking the world had ever seen, and it culminated in the development of the world's first nuclear weapons for the U.S. military. Those bombs put an end to World War II in the Pacific and laid the groundwork for the nuclear world order. Fermi and the Manhattan Project embodied an age of discovery that rewarded quality over quantity and expertise. In nuclear physics, the 1930s and 1940s were an age of fundamental breakthroughs, and when it came to making those breakthroughs, one Enrico Fermi was worth thousands of less brilliant physicists. American leadership in this era was built in large part on attracting geniuses like Fermi, men and women who could single-handedly tip the scales of scientific power. But not every technological revolution follows this pattern. Often, once a fundamental breakthrough has been achieved, the center of gravity quickly shifts from a handful of elite researchers to an army of tinkerers, engineers with just enough expertise to apply the technology to different problems. This is particularly true when the payoff of a breakthrough is diffused throughout society rather than concentrated in a few labs or weapons systems. Mass electrification exemplified this process. Following Thomas Edison's harnessing of electricity, the field rapidly shifted from invention to implementation. Thousands of engineers began tinkering with electricity, using it to power new devices and reorganized industrial processes. Those tinkerers didn't have to break new ground like Edison. They just had to know enough about how electricity worked to turn its power into useful and profitable machines. Our present phase of AI implementation fits this latter model. A constant stream of headlines about the latest task tackled by AI gives us the mistaken sense that we are living through an age of discovery, a time when the Enrico Fermis of the world determine the balance of power. In reality, we are witnessing the application of one fundamental breakthrough, deep learning and related techniques, to many problems. That's a process that requires well-trained AI scientists, the tinkerers of this age. Today, those tinkerers are putting AI's superhuman powers of pattern recognition to use, making loans, driving cars, translating text, playing Go, and powering your Amazon Alexa. Deep learning pioneers like Jeffrey Hinton, Jan LeCun, and Joshua Bengio, the Enrico Fermis of AI, continue to push the boundaries of artificial intelligence. And they may yet produce another game-changing breakthrough, one that scrambles the global technological pecking order. But in the meantime, the real action today is with the tinkerers. Intelligence sharing. And for this technological revolution, the tinkerers have an added advantage: real-time access to the work of leading pioneers. During the Industrial Revolution, national borders and language barriers meant that new industrial breakthroughs remained bottled up in their country of origin, England. America's cultural proximity and loose intellectual property laws helped it pilfer some key inventions, but there remained a substantial lag between the innovator and the imitator. Not so today. When asked how far China lags behind Silicon Valley in artificial intelligence research, some Chinese entrepreneurs jokingly answer 16 hours, the time difference between California and Beijing. America may be home to the top researchers, but much of their work and insight is instantaneously available to anyone with an internet connection and a grounding in AI fundamentals. Facilitating this knowledge transfer are two defining traits of the AI research community: openness and speed. Artificial intelligence researchers tend to be quite open about publishing their algorithms, data, and results. That openness grew out of the common goal of advancing the field and also from the desire for objective metrics and competitions. In many physical sciences, experiments cannot be fully replicated from one lab to the next. Minute variations in technique or environment can greatly affect results. But AI experiments are perfectly replicable, and algorithms are directly comparable. They simply require those algorithms to be trained and tested on identical data sets. International competitions frequently pit different computer vision or speech recognition teams against each other, with the competitors opening their work to scrutiny by other researchers. The speed of improvements in AI also drives researchers to instantly share their results. Many AI scientists aren't trying to make fundamental breakthroughs on the scale of deep learning, but they are constantly making marginal improvements to the best algorithms. These improvements regularly set new records for accuracy on tasks like speech recognition or visual identification. Researchers compete on the basis of these records, not on new products or revenue numbers. And when one sets a new record, he or she wants to be recognized and receive credit for the achievement. But given the rapid pace of improvements, many researchers fear that if they wait to publish in a journal, their record will already have been eclipsed and their moment at the cutting edge will go undocumented. So instead of sitting on that research, they opt for instant publication on websites like www.arxiv.org or arxiv.org, an online repository of scientific papers. The site lets researchers instantly timestamp their research, planting a stake in the ground to mark the when and what of their algorithmic achievements. In the post-AlphaGo world, Chinese students, researchers, and engineers are among the most voracious readers of arxiv.org. They troll the site for new techniques, soaking up everything the world's top researchers have to offer. Alongside these academic publications, Chinese AI students also stream, translate, and subtitle lectures from leading AI scientists like Yan LeCun, Stanford's Sebastian Thrun, and Andrew Ng. After decades spent studying outdated textbooks in the dark, these researchers revel in this instant connectivity to global research trends. On WeChat, China's AI community coalesces into giant group chats and multimedia platforms to chew over what's new in AI. 13 new media companies have sprung up just to cover the sector, offering industry news, expert analysis, and open-ended dialogue. These AI-focused outlets boast over 1 million registered users, and half of them have taken on venture funding that values them at more than $10 million each. For more academic discussions, I'm part of the 500-member weekly paper discussion group, just one of the dozens of WeChat groups that come together to dissect a new AI research publication each week. The chat group buzzes with hundreds of messages per day, earnest questions about this week's paper, screenshots of the members' latest algorithmic achievements, and, of course, plenty of animated emojis. But Chinese AI practitioners aren't just passive recipients of wisdom spilling forth from the Western world. They're now giving back to that research ecosystem at an accelerating rate. Conference conflicts. The Association for the Advancement of Artificial Intelligence had a problem. The storied organization had been putting on one of the world's most important AI conferences for 3 decades, but in 2017, they were in danger of hosting a dud event. Why? The conference dates conflicted with Chinese New Year. A few years earlier, this wouldn't have been a problem. Historically, American, British, and Canadian scholars have dominated the proceedings, with just a handful of Chinese researchers presenting papers. But the 2017 conference had accepted an almost equal number of papers from researchers in China and the United States, and it was in danger of losing half of that equation to their culture's most important holiday. Nobody would have put AAAI on Christmas Day, the group's president told The Atlantic. Our organization had to almost turn on a dime and change the conference venue to hold it a week later. Chinese AI contributions have occurred at all levels, ranging from marginal tweaks of existing models to the introduction of world-class new approaches to neural network construction. A look at citations and academic research reveals the growing cloud of Chinese researchers. One study by Sinovation Ventures examined citations in the top 100 AI journals and conferences from 2006 to 2015. It found that the percentage of papers by authors with Chinese names nearly doubled from 23.2% to 42.8% during that time. That total includes some authors with Chinese names who work abroad. For example, Chinese-American researchers who haven't adopted an anglicized name. But a survey of the authors' research institutions found the great majority of them to be working in China. A recent tally of citations at global research institutions confirmed the trend. That ranking of the 100 most cited research institutions on AI from 2012 to 2016 showed China ranking second only to the United States. Among the elite institutions, Tsinghua University even outnumbered places like Stanford University in total AI citations. These studies largely captured the pre-AlphaGo era, before China pushed even more researchers into the field. In the coming years, a whole new wave of young PhD students will bring Chinese AI research to a new level. And these contributions haven't just been about piling up papers and citations. Researchers in the country have produced some of the most important advances in neural networks and computer vision since the arrival of deep learning. Many of these researchers emerged out of Microsoft Research China, an institution that I founded in 1998. Later renamed Microsoft Research Asia, it went on to train over 5,000 AI researchers, including top executives at Baidu, Alibaba, Tencent, Lenovo, and Huawei. In 2015, a team from Microsoft Research Asia blew the competition out of the water at the Global Image Recognition Competition, ImageNet, The team's breakthrough algorithm was called ResNet, and it identified and classified objects from 100,000 photographs into 1,000 different categories with an error rate of just 3.5%. 2 years later, when Google's DeepMind built AlphaGo Zero, the self-taught successor to AlphaGo, they used ResNet as one of its core technological building blocks. The Chinese researchers behind ResNet didn't stay at Microsoft for long. Of the four authors of the ResNet paper, one joined Yann LeCun's research team at Facebook, but the other three have founded and joined AI startups in China. One of those startups, Face++, has quickly turned into a world leader in face and image recognition technology. At the 2017 COCO Image Recognition Competition, the Face++ team took first place in three of the four most important categories, beating out the top teams from Google, Microsoft, and Facebook. To some observers in the West, these research achievements fly in the face of deeply held beliefs about the nature of knowledge and research across political systems. Shouldn't Chinese controls on the Internet hobble the ability of Chinese researchers to break new ground globally? There are valid critiques of China's system of governance, ones that weigh heavily on public debate and research in the social sciences. But when it comes to research in the hard sciences, these issues are not nearly as limiting as many outsiders presume. Artificial intelligence doesn't touch on sensitive political questions, and China's AI scientists are essentially as free as their American counterparts to construct cutting-edge algorithms or build profitable AI applications. But don't take it from me. At a 2017 conference on artificial intelligence and global security, former Google CEO Eric Schmidt warned participants against complacency when it came to Chinese AI capabilities. Predicting that China would match American AI capabilities in 5 years, Schmidt was blunt in his assessment. "Trust me, these Chinese people are good. If you have any kind of prejudice or concern that somehow their system and their educational system is not going to produce the kind of people that I'm talking about, you're wrong." The Seven Giants and the Next Deep Learning. But while the global AI research community has blossomed into a fluid and open system, one component of that ecosystem remains more closed off: big corporate research labs. Academic researchers may rush to share their work with the world, but public technology companies have a fiduciary responsibility to maximize profits for their shareholders. That usually means less publishing and more proprietary technology. Of the hundreds of companies pouring resources into AI research, let's return to the seven that have emerged as the new giants of corporate AI research: Google, Facebook, Amazon, Microsoft, Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent. These seven giants have, in effect, morphed into what nations were 50 years ago. That is, large and relatively closed-off systems that concentrate talent and resources on breakthroughs that will mostly remain in-house. The seals around corporate research are never airtight. Team members leave to found their own AI startups, and some groups like Microsoft Research, Facebook AI Research, and DeepMind still publish articles on their most meaningful contributions. But broadly speaking, if one of these companies makes a unique breakthrough, a trade secret that could generate massive profits for that company alone, it will do its best to keep a lid on it and will try to extract maximum value before the word gets out. A groundbreaking discovery occurring within one of these closed systems poses the greatest threat to the world's open AI ecosystem. It also threatens to stymie China in its goal of becoming a global leader in AI. The way things stand today, China already has the edge in entrepreneurship, data, and government support, and it's rapidly catching up to the United States in expertise. If the technological status quo holds for the coming years, an array of Chinese AI startups will begin fanning out across different industries. They will leverage deep learning and other machine learning technologies to disrupt dozens of sectors and reap the rewards of transforming the economy. But if the next breakthrough on the scale of deep learning occurs soon, and it happens within a hermetically sealed corporate environment, all bets are off. It could give one company an insurmountable advantage over the other seven giants and return us to an age of discovery in which elite expertise tips the balance of power in favor of the United States. To be clear, I believe the odds are slightly against such a breakthrough coming out of the corporate behemoths in the coming years. Deep learning marked the largest leap forward in the past 50 years, and advances on this scale rarely come more than once every few decades. Even if such a breakthrough does occur, it's more likely to emerge out of the open environment of academia. Right now, the corporate giants are pouring unprecedented resources into squeezing deep learning for all it's worth. That means lots of fine-tuning of deep learning algorithms and only a small percentage of truly open-ended research in pursuit of the next paradigm-shifting breakthrough. Meanwhile, academics find themselves unable to compete with industry in practical applications of deep learning because of the requirements for massive amounts of data and computing power. So instead, many academic researchers are following Jeffrey Hinton's exhortation to move on and focus on inventing the next deep learning, a fundamentally new approach to AI problems that could change the game. That type of open-ended research is the kind most likely to stumble onto the next breakthrough and then publish it for all the world to learn from. Google versus the rest. But if the next deep learning is destined to be discovered in the corporate world, Google has the best shot at it. Among the seven AI giants, Google, more precisely its parent company Alphabet, which owns DeepMind and its self-driving subsidiary Waymo, stands head and shoulders above the rest. It was one of the earliest companies to see the potential in deep learning and has devoted more resources to harnessing it than any other company. In terms of funding, Google dwarfs even its own government. U.S. federal funding for math and computer science research amounts to less than half of Google's own R&D budget. That spending spree has bought Alphabet an outsized share of the world's brightest AI minds. Of the top 100 AI researchers and engineers, around half are already working for Google. The other half are distributed among the remaining seven giants, academia, and a handful of smaller startups. Microsoft and Facebook have soaked up substantial portions of this group, with Facebook bringing on superstar researchers like Yan LeCun. Of the Chinese giants, Baidu went into deep learning research earliest, even trying to acquire Jeffrey Hinton's startup in 2013 before being outbid by Google, and scored a major coup in 2014 when it recruited Andrew Ng to head up its Silicon Valley AI lab. Within a year, that hire was showing outstanding results. By 2015, Baidu's AI algorithms had exceeded human abilities at Chinese speech recognition. It was a great accomplishment, but one that went largely unnoticed in the United States. In fact, when Microsoft reached the same milestone a year later for English, the company dubbed it a historic achievement. Ng left Baidu in 2017 to create his own AI investment fund, but the time he spent at the company both testified to Baidu's ambitions and strengthened its reputation for research. Alibaba and Tencent were relative latecomers to the AI talent race, but they have the cash and data on hand to attract top talent. With WeChat serving as the all-in-one super app of the world's largest internet market, Tencent possesses perhaps the single richest data ecosystem of all the giants. That is now helping Tencent to attract and empower top-flight AI researchers. In 2017, Tencent opened an AI research institute in Seattle and immediately began poaching Microsoft researchers to staff it. Alibaba has followed suit with plans to open a global network of research labs, including in Silicon Valley and Seattle. Thus far, Tencent and Alibaba have yet to publicly demonstrate the results of this research, opting instead for more product-driven applications. Alibaba has taken the lead on City Brains, massive AI-driven networks that optimize city services by drawing on data from video cameras, social media, public transit, and location-based apps. Working with the city government in its hometown of Hangzhou, Alibaba is using advanced object recognition and predictive transit algorithms to constantly tweak the patterns for red lights and alert emergency services to traffic accidents. The trial has increased traffic speeds by 10% in some areas, and Alibaba is now preparing to bring the service to other cities. While Google may have jumped off to a massive head start in the arms race for elite AI talent, that by no means guarantees victory. As discussed, fundamental breakthroughs are few and far between, and paradigm-shifting discoveries often emerge from unexpected places. Deep learning came out of a small network of idiosyncratic researchers obsessed with an approach to machine learning that had been dismissed by mainstream researchers. If the next deep learning is out there somewhere, it could be hiding on any number of university campuses or in corporate labs, and there's no guessing when or where it will show its face. While the world waits for the lottery of scientific discovery to produce a new breakthrough, we remain entrenched in our current era of AI implementation. Power grids versus AI batteries. But the giants aren't just competing against one another in a race for the next deep learning. They're also in a more immediate race against the small AI startups that want to use machine learning to revolutionize specific industries. It's a contest between the two approaches to distributing the electricity of AI across the economy. The grid approach of the seven giants versus the battery approach of the startups. How that race plays out will determine the nature of the AI business landscape. Monopoly, oligopoly, or freewheeling competition among hundreds of companies. The grid approach is trying to commoditize AI. It aims to turn the power of machine learning into a standardized service that can be purchased by any company, or even be given away for free for academic or personal use, and accessed via cloud computing platforms. In this model, cloud computing platforms act as the grid, performing complex machine learning optimizations on whatever data problems users require. The companies behind these platforms, Google, Alibaba, and Amazon, act as the utility companies, managing the grid and collecting the fees. Hooking into that grid would allow traditional companies with large data sets to easily tap into AI's optimization powers without having to remake their entire business around it. Google's TensorFlow, an open-source software ecosystem for building deep learning models, offers an early version of this, but still requires some AI expertise to operate. The goal of the grid approach is to both lower that expertise threshold and increase the functionality of these AI platforms. Making use of machine learning is nowhere near as simple as plugging an electric appliance into the wall, and it may never be. But the AI giants hope to push things in that direction and then reap the rewards of generating the power and operating the grid. AI startups are taking the opposite approach. Instead of waiting for this grid to take shape, startups are building highly specific battery-powered AI products for each use case. These startups are banking on depth rather than breadth. Instead of supplying general-purpose machine learning capabilities, they build new products and train algorithms for specific tasks, including medical diagnosis, mortgage lending, and autonomous drones. They are betting that traditional businesses won't be able to simply plug the nitty-gritty details of their daily operations into an all-purpose grid. Instead of helping those companies access AI, these startups want to disrupt them using AI. They aim to build AI-first companies from the ground up, creating a new roster of industry champions for the AI age. It's far too early to pick a winner between the grid and battery approaches. While giants like Google steadily spread their tentacles outward, startups in China and the United States are racing to claim virgin territory and fortify themselves against incursions by the seven giants. How that scramble for territory shakes out will determine the shape of our new economic landscape. It could concentrate astronomical profits in the hands of the seven giants, the super utilities of the AI age. Or diffuse those profits out across thousands of vibrant new companies. The chip on China's shoulder. One under-discussed area of AI competition among the AI giants, startups, and the two countries is in computer chips, also known as semiconductors. High-performance chips are the unsexy